Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Southern Plains Podcast. I'm Clay Pope. I work with the USDA Southern Plains Climate Hub in El Reno, Oklahoma. And this podcast is a joint venture of the Climate Hub and the Redlands Community College Division of Agriculture, also located in El Reno. We want to thank each and every one of you for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. And our guest on the podcast today is Amy Seeger with the Oklahoma Conservation Commission. Amy is the Director of Soil Health Activities for the Commission. Amy, is that correct? Am I saying that right?
Yes, I'm the Oklahoma Conservation Commission and also a joint venture with the Nature Conservancy and the NRCS.
Well, wonderful, Amy, and that's probably the best way to lead in because I wanted to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started into work for the Conservation Commission.
Well, it could start from long ago, or it can we can make it short. But I grew up on a farm southeastern Oklahoma, and I would say my grandfather probably started me in conservation. He worked for the water board at a small town, and took me out to where the water treatment plant was long before I even knew what conservation was. So, and then fast forward, my dad got me into land judging and was on the board on the Conservation Commission, or on the district board. And then Rachel Sutton was a board member. And so between land judging, my grandparents, and the love of soil, I've led into this route. So,
well, what exactly do you do for the commission there on with the, you said director, is that the right title, Director of Soil Health Activities, or what is your title with the commission, and what work do you do for them?
So I'm the state soil health. It started out as a coordinator, but it really is a programs director position. And so we work with 84 districts across the state, conservation districts. I also work tightly with the NRCS staff in those counties. And then I communicate with the Nature Conservancy, just trying to feed the communication between everybody on what soil is, how we're promoting it and educating, and just keeping everybody aware of what's going on.
Now, you said this is a joint venture between the commission and the Nature Conservancy. How does that work? How is that set up?
So the Nature Conservancy obviously has opportunities for private funding and felt very compassionate about the soil health, and that management of lands is really going to come from the landowners. And so they felt the commission and the NRCS was a great opportunity to, they've already have the communication developed between the districts and the volunteer of landowners getting conservation on the ground. And instead of recreating the wheel, funding a position that will continue to promote the education was one of their drives. The NRCS and the commission have been working together for years on soil health, and the need for education has grown tremendously since they started it in early 2000s, and trying to organize 84 different districts and events going on in our limited supply of professional staff that can speak on it becomes a challenge. So I help get the right people in the right places at the right time and also promote those events as well.
Well, you know, you're talking about those events. What are some of the outreach and education efforts that you're doing for the commission, and what kind of programs are you undertaking right now?
So our programs range from urban to rural and everything in between. The districts themselves establish resource concerns. So we'll have field days if they feel like that's going to reach their public the best, and go out to farms or bring in-classroom education, depending on what their goals are, to discuss the beginnings of soil health to the advanced stages of soil health and the practices that promote that. So the districts give me a call, and we'll set up classrooms that our class field days on grazing. We'll set up field days on cropland and cover crops, and work with the OACD and other partners to get the right professionals at the right time. So, and we've also worked with the district in doing community outreach through pollinators. So we feel that soil health is more of an ecosystems approach, and not only includes the health of the soil, but the health of the soil comes from the plants on top of the soil and obviously feeds the ecosystem around it. So we've been able to do some community outreach through Urban on Lawn Care, and Plant ID is a great one that we work with on producers, but also with urban development as well.
When you're talking all of these things, with soil health touches so many areas. You've mentioned just in that answering that question alone, just management of the ecosystem, pollinators, helping folks in urban areas. You know, I guess that kind of leads my next question in, just kind of a thumbnail sketch for our listeners. What is soil health, and talk a little bit about why there is so much interest in not just conservation circles, but with so many folks on improving the health of the soil, if you would.
So our soil is a living carbon filter, if you may. If we think about the soil as a filter in our refrigerators, the coal, you know, our coal filters, our carbon filters clean the water that comes from our faucets into our drinking glasses. If we look at it as an environmental scale and in a natural setting, our soil is our carbon filter for our lakes, our streams, and drinking water ultimately. And if we get that right at the beginning, and it reduced costs in the long run on water treatment and things like that. So soil health to me and to several within our community is a balanced ecosystem, living community in the soil, and that is fed by the plant community on top of the soil. And so it varies. We have soil all across the board. A healthy soil will filter water correctly, and unhealthy soil more than likely will end up with runoff and turbidity in our creeks and our streams. So nutrient loading, things like that, that can occur from an unhealthy soil.
Well, so that just really dovetails well into the work that the commission's been doing for years on water quality, doesn't it? I mean, the non-point source success that Oklahoma has seen in taking streams off the 303D list with the EPA, it really sounds like that soil health it plays an integral role in that and can play an even bigger role in the future. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, definitely. We have seen huge impacts just within the last few years. Our numbers have grown tremendously on the removal of streams off the 303D list. And it's a huge part of the partnership between the NRCS and our local districts addressing those resource concerns, and soil health being one of those major points of concern. So if we get what's done right on the land, we'll have great quality of water in the long run. And it cannot be accomplished without the commission, the NRCS, and our local districts joining together in efforts, for sure.
Well, and I know you've recently talked a little bit about some benefits beyond just water quality. You guys have talked a lot about, especially in light of some of the weather events that we've seen over the last few months, about the impact that it can have as far as water holding capacity and what that could mean as far as flood control too. Can you talk a little bit about some of that as far as the water holding capacity in the soil and what soil health means in that whole discussion?
Sure. So recently, not to make light of the situation, but we did have floods and continue. It's been a struggle, I believe, even this fall with heavy rains in the northeastern part of the state. And we had some also in our western part. And if you look at the history of Oklahoma, our soils have been depleted of organic matter since we broke the land by improving it in the land run, and have lost a lot of topsoil. And we've lost anywhere from, I would say, 3 to 5%. And for every 1% of organic matter added per acre, you'll receive 25,000 gallons of water holding capacity. And what that meant was we went and looked back at the lands around the flooding up north and did an average. If we had increased our percent organic matter at least by 1% from where it is now, which wouldn't be near as much as what it could be. But the 1% was enough for that area to be enough water holding capacity for our top four water reservoirs in Oklahoma. And so plus Canton Lake. So that's a huge eye opener for us on what the potentials could be as we progress through this journey of soil health.
So you're saying if you can increase the organic matter in some of these areas, potentially just by 1%, you could see the soil, just make sure I'm saying this right and that I heard you right, that you'd be increasing the water holding capacity of the soil enough where it could hold as much moisture, as much rainfall as our top four reservoirs in Oklahoma, plus Canton Lake, which is one of Oklahoma City's primary drinking water supplies. You could hold that much moisture in the soil in those areas that were deluged by the flooding this last spring?
Yes, so it was the HUC 12 location near the Arkansas River.
So that would be in the Arkansas River, so that'd be up north of Tulsa and up into that area?
Yeah.
But it was basically it's the watershed above Tulsa and the Arkansas River that if you could increase that water holding capacity, that could be a huge cushion as far as not just trying to do things as far as holding water to help control, to help mitigate future heavy rain events as far as the impact it would have on flash flooding, but also holding that moisture, that slower release can also help with intermittent stream flow. And I would think when it dries off, that also means that you're going to increase, you have the chance to give you a buffer to survive those flash drought periods for folks downstream drinking water and also for water for livestock and for growing crops and forage as well. Is that kind of what comes out of that also?
It is, and not only is it the water holding capacity, but as you progress through the soil health practices, you'll also see water infiltration rates increase. So if we had a compacted site, for example, I've done some infiltration studies across, in particular, Bermuda grass lawns, but we could say the same for some of our Bermuda grass fields. It was a quick Band-Aid as you on a construction site, you want to get soil or sod on there as soon as possible. Well, the immediate thought is to put it down right where it's at. And so you've got compacted subsoil, basically, that you're applying a small layer of Bermuda grass to. And so if you do infiltration rates on those numbers, ultimately we were not getting any infiltration rates as I tested across lawns in Oklahoma City, which most of our rains, as you know, do not come in small intermittent drizzles. It's 1 to 2 inches in a short amount of time. And so with no water infiltration, you're not even retaining the water. So if you don't have the organic matter to hold it on and you don't have the availability to take it in, all your water is going downstream. And in particular, in the Oklahoma City area, the average lawn for an inch rainfall is donating 4,000 plus gallons of water to stormwater because it's not able to infiltrate or hold on to it because of the organic matter depletion.
Well, I would think any kind of fertilizer or any kind of insecticide or pesticide that you've put on those lawns too. And, I've got family that lives in Oklahoma City, my in-laws especially, and I love my father-in-law, but he's one of those guys that wants to have something that looks like he's on the par six out at Oak Tree on his front lawn. And, I try to convince him that, God meant this country for a little more biologically diverse system. And in the summertime, when it's dry, it's not supposed to be all green. That's not how it's supposed to work. But that doesn't convince him very well. And he likes to put all the improvements that he can on his lawn. But it seems to me if you're not infiltrating any water, any residue that's left on that lawn is going to go right down in the stormwater system and cause problems as far as water quality for the metro area as well, or at least for the folks downstream anyway.
Right. So we do apply, if you look at some of the principles for soil health, one of them is reduce disturbance. Well, if we look at basic lawn maintenance, our disturbance is our mowing and chemical treatment. And to some extent, we just apply without really knowing the knowledge of what's already there. And if we can, at least we did a study in a research plot with Oklahoma City in And we just encouraged if you could change at least one thing, which we would promote several, but if you could at least change one thing, we looked at your mow height or just adding compost to the site. And both the compost and the increased mow height worked well. But when you combine the two, we had water, an inch of water that infiltrated in less than a minute on that site versus the site that was still mechanically treated the same and chemically, where it sat for over 30 to 40 minutes. And so it's a huge education across the board, but still a lot to get out. But it's not only on the urban side, it's also rural, and it's a good communicator between the two. We're all donating to the environmental impact, whether it's stormwater or creek water. It's just how we manage our one little place.
Well, and it sounds to me like as far as a tool to help address some of these natural resource concerns, especially, you know, we've touched on flooding, you touched on water quality earlier. I guess what we're talking about here in the urban areas as far as stormwater runoff has an impact both on flooding and water quality as well. And then, of course, soil erosion, getting back to the agricultural side, it sounds to me like to address multiple natural resource concerns, soil health really is one of the best tools that that agencies like the Conservation Commission has in their toolkit to try to get a handle on these issues.
It really is. Again, if you go back to our history and what was naturally set up for an environmental, it was our soil. Our soil was our buffer. It kept things cycling. And if you look at it as a circle and you take a piece of that out, that circle stops. And where's ultimately our water going to end up if it's not going through our soil? It's going to go into our streams immediately without any filtering. And so nature had a great way of having a carbon filter available to us, and we've beat it up a bit, but it's not unrecoverable. And just taking some of these small steps on your own place, you can look up the 5 basic principles anywhere on the web for soil health. Some of them are tailored obviously more towards farmland because it's a larger area of coverage of available management. But when we start looking at our urban sites that are sprawling and increasing the maintenance that goes on to the lawns and the chemicals that go on to the lawns, those are increasing as well. And not managed quite as tightly because it's less area to cover. So the pocketbook's not hit as hard as it is sometimes in the farming aspect. And so if we can encourage soil testing, encourage diversity, we'll have a better ecosystem. I mentioned pollinators before. If we can include clover into our lawns, you can reduce mowing times, obviously, but you also have a nutrient source for those pollinators coming out of the winter. And then also you have nitrogen given back from the plant to the Bermuda grass later on. And so we're also encouraging that in our grazing lands that have Bermuda grass and hay, incorporating diversity, which is one of our principles in the cool season. So get some clovers in there, get some ryegrass in there. It'll give them 365 grazing ultimately is our goal. Obviously in Oklahoma, it probably won't be 365 grazing, but they can reduce their hay by quite a bit if they have that cool season vegetation for the cattle to eat on.
We know, and kind of leading into my next question, because I want to try to cycle a little bit back to agriculture after we talk some about our urban soils. You know, I know that coming from Southeast Oklahoma, you've got a real soft spot in your heart for folks in the cattle industry, especially cow-calf producers that may or may not have any cropland. And it seems so much of the time on soil health, we do have a tendency to focus a little bit more on say winter wheat and cotton in states like Oklahoma, because it's tied to those USDA program crops and it covers so much of our farmland, especially in central and western Oklahoma. But you know, there's definitely a need to improve the health of the soil on our pasture and rangelands, and I know you put a real focus on that. Could you talk a little bit about some of the efforts that you've done on soil health on grazing land in the state of Oklahoma and kind of what that looks like.
Well, sure. And it's been a team effort by far. We've got great partners throughout the whole state, and their goals have been at grazing. And ultimately, you know, we know that the farmers need to make a profit, and we've seen benefits from the soil health and in reducing pesticide use. You know, reduce the cost by buying the pesticide, but also, you know, not driving as much on the tractor. So you have time saved and cost saved on diesel and the chemical. But what we're really focusing on as a team is the grazing perspective, whether it's rotational grazing, intense grazing, or just education on what a cow will eat or not eat. We've had it in our head for so long. And I think part of it is it was an easy, or it isn't easy. We know what to do with Bermuda grass. We can, we know when to fertilize, we know when to spray, we know when to cut for hay. And then adding cattle in there occasionally as well. And I'm speaking from this personally because, growing up on a farm, my dad had a second job, right? His full-time job was, FSA director down there. And then farming was part-time. So you had to have some stability on what you were doing to know when to do it. Because your time was so tight as it was. But what we're learning with the soil health practices, if we can increase the diversity in the grazing, it's reducing time spent with the farmer, and they have other time to do other things. But our focus has been adding diversity within Bermuda grass. It's hard to do while the Bermuda grass is growing, but we can definitely do it in the cool season. And adding whether you do a spreader or a no-till drill within the Bermuda grass, just getting a little bit of cool season mix in there with a wide diversity more than just grass, has been helpful. And it also reduces the cost, like I said before, with haying. They're having to re-hay a lot less. And in a native rangeland setting, we've been doing a lot of education on the plant diversity. And if we keep our cattle a little bit tighter and graze in a tighter scenario, we won't have necessarily the problems with weed. And if you graze it properly, it'll shade it out, shade out the weeds.
Now, when you say grazing in a tighter scenario, you're talking about the high impact managed grazing, mob grazing. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. So the intense grazing systems are a mob style of grazing. The cattle can get very competitive, and they will eat what they're available. And we've seen them eat everything from ragweed at a young age. It actually has high protein values. It'll keep a lot of the weeds at control if you do the mob style grazing. But we understand, too, that there are farmers that just cannot necessarily do that. So we try to work with them and their practices to best adjust accordingly.
Well, now, and talking with the producers now, you know, you've mentioned several things that are of benefit, whether you're talking about reducing chemical inputs, reducing fuel use, trying to limit the amount of time that you have to spend on a tractor. You've talked a little bit about trying to reduce as much dependency on hay, doing more, having more forage available for a longer period of time, which has, again, not just on the money for hay, but if you're doing your own hay and, you know, equipment time and things like your time trying to bale the hay, and then, you know, things that are associated with all of that. But you know, how have the producers responded as you've had this message to them? Because, you know, we've talked about a lot of things here, both from environmental impact as far as the benefits we see to the natural resource base, but now also there's an impact as far as things that should, or hopefully, or, you know, if anecdotal evidence would suggest, do help producers' bottom lines. What kind of response are you hearing from farmers and ranchers out there as you're doing this education and outreach work for the commission?
So we have several that have been spotlighted and have been an educational tool for us to educate their peers. We have several that we range from rangeland grazing that have reduced their expense costs by quite a bit by not haying and just rotating and working on a conservation plan. And they work tightly with the NRCS to develop that, and has been very successful. We also have producers that are doing not necessarily rangeland, but multi-species grazing, and so they're using cattle and sheep. But they're also, we have some that are diversifying their grazing production, And by able to reduce the hay time, the energy, the money spent on hay, they're seeing a huge impact on their environmental area around them, the ecosystem. I have one farmer that takes his binoculars with him because he's seen a diversity in birds in his area. The cattle are healthier. He's able to reduce the amount of warmer he's using, which is also making a huge impact on the microbiology in the soil. And he has reduced costs in using the warmer. So when we work with the land instead of against the land, we ultimately end up all winning in the long run.
Well, and that's what, you know, as we move forward, what do you see as the future of soil health efforts in the state? What are some of the things that the commission and the NRCS, your partners with the Nature Conservancy, other folks have on tap for the future? What's some of the big initiatives that you're going to be working on?
So education is our biggest asset. And we just work with a tight, close team of several that are inspired and excited about soil health and where we're going and where we've been. And I see nothing but good things ahead of us. The word is gradually growing and expanding, and we'll continue to educate. We're going to continue to go to each district if we need to, or a group, a regional, providing education on whether it's grazing or cover crops and grazing wheat even. So I don't foresee anything changing except for the expansion. I see more expansion of education and providing those opportunities for those farmers to talk with peers that are making things happen on their land and giving them hope that it can happen on their land. There's a huge time of change that occurs when someone starts adopting soil health, and the soil we've beat for 100 years. And so now we're trying to change it almost instantly, and it doesn't happen quite that fast. I wish it would, just for the farmer's perspective. But, you know, connecting through education and opportunity, farmer to farmer, mentor to mentor, education, I think is, I can't say enough of it.
A question too, you know, we've talked a lot about producers and landowners, homeowners. There's another group though, as far as education, and that's our policymakers and some of the decision makers out there. You'd mentioned a little bit about how your father, I believe, worked on water, you know, on drinking water and drinking water systems there as you're growing up as a kid. What has the commission done, or what have you heard from folks with other groups, like say the Water Resources Board, with our, you know, with community water suppliers, people who are in the position? Because it seems like, you know, we've got a tool here that has such great benefit as far as water quality. I think you guys at the commission have proved that, you know, you can improve or reduce non-point source pollution by doing things that help control erosion, help improve the health of the soil. We've mentioned a lot about the lawns. You know, you touched on carbon for a second, and we really haven't even talked about that, but the carbon sequestration and avoided emissions and what that can mean on greenhouse gas levels, besides just helping guys prepare for extreme weather, doing things to help mitigate climate change. And it seems like so much of the time that gets lost in a lot of discussion when people talk about policies and trying to address some of these issues, that we've got this great tool that can help us deal with so many challenges and do it in a way that also helps producers' bottom line. How is that being received by some of the folks outside of our circle? You know, we kind of feel, sometimes I feel like those of us who work in conservation and in regenerative agriculture and soil health, I almost feel like we've found the Rosetta Stone in so many ways, you know, but trying to get people to understand just exactly what we have and what the impact can be sometimes seems to be a pretty big challenge. Is the commission making any headway with that, or have you know, is that something that's in the future, or how is that discussion going?
Well, I would say that's definitely always at the forefront, especially for our executive director. He understands, he's a farmer as well, what impacts this has on water quality and on production land. So he is always trying to find opportunities to educate our policymakers at any time. And we, as a group, as a state agency, and we work with several other state agencies, and I foresee that several of them understand the importance of it. not necessarily see it every day like we do, but they do know the importance and how it's impacting the area. We, as a commission in the Water Quality Division, we are funded through the 319 funds, and so there's always open communication between us and in our Region 6 EPA office. And they, too, see the importance of soil health and the practical sense of getting education to the localized farmers, so education within their area. So I think you'll see more and more either opportunities for farmers to learn through some fundings or policies being made, hopefully even on an urban scale, to address some of these issues.
Well, outstanding. Well, Amy, we're just about, I've taken probably enough of your time today, and I appreciate you taking time to be on the podcast. But before we wrap it up, is there anything else that you would like to leave with our listeners, or any message that you'd like to leave with the folks that that tune into the podcast about the work that you do there at the commission?
Sure. I would say one first and foremost is that I feel very fortunate to be where I'm at this stage. And we have several people we work with that are not only interested in the soil health, but also actually practice it. And farmers are very near and dear to my heart. And I think we encourage things that will help them and not hurt them. And so we have education opportunities across the state. I have an email that I send out monthly with a calendar of events, and has flyers for each event, so you can find the location easily and the contact for the RSVP. So if you're interested in that, you can go on to the Oklahoma Conservation Commission website and sign up for our emails under Soil Health Education. And then we also have a Facebook page, and we put our site, our events on that as well, and also some little tidbits of information to learn from and resources. So that's Oklahoma Soil Health, and I encourage those that are interested to link in there as well.
Well, that's wonderful. And Amy, thank you so much for being with us today and taking time out of your day to visit with us on the podcast. And I want to thank all of you listening at home for taking time out of your day to tune in and listen to this episode of the Southern Plains Podcast. This has been the Southern Plains Podcast. And again, this podcast is a joint venture of the USDA Southern Plains Climate Hub and Redlands Community College Division of Agriculture, both of which are located in El Reno, Oklahoma. We thank you again for listening in, and have a great day.